This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice. And Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here today.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to this conversation. You know, earlier, as you well know, earlier this year, Deloitte released its Global Defense Outlook 2013, sort of titled Balancing Security and Prosperity. And it's sort of, as I understand it, examined current policies, practices, and trends affecting defense planning and budgets profiles across the top 50 nations in terms of spending. That's what we're going to talk about today. You are a prime driver in putting together that report, Jack. But first, I wanted to give you a chance to give the folks a little bit about your background.
Well, thanks very much. And it's a pleasure to talk with you. I'm part of a great global team at Deloitte Consulting. We focus on serving top management clients in the defense and intelligence communities around the world. What we really like to do is help leaders create and then implement strategies for dealing with large-scale changes, you know, new missions, new resource constraints, new policy environments, and there's certainly a lot of that around.
Yeah, especially right now with in the midst of the shutdown and all that going on. So, yeah, it's definitely a challenging time. So how did you end up at Deloitte?
Well, I joined Deloitte in 2011. Most of my career has been as a management consultant for top leaders in corporations and governments around the world. I started my career as an Army officer. I'm a West Point graduate, spent 11 years on active duty. And just before I joined Deloitte, I had the privilege of going back into federal service for a year. I worked in Afghanistan as an advisor to COM ISAF on transition strategy with the Afghans, rule of law, detention operations, biometrics, that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, fascinating stuff, and thank you for your service. So, Jack, let's turn to the report. And my first question, you know, I like the title, Balancing Security and Prosperity. Why that title? Why did you guys look at that as a theme for the report?
We talked a lot about how to title the report. And the title, Balancing Security and Prosperity, reflects the perspective that we brought to the entire report. Kissinger once said, all policy is proportion. And the way we came at defense policy was not through the traditional ways of looking at geographies or regional points of view or technology. Rather, we come at the challenge of defense spending from a macroeconomic perspective. We're looking at defense spending as one of the choices that governments make about how much money to spend and where to spend their money. The money that's spent on defense creates jobs. It creates new businesses, it creates innovation, and of course it creates security. But in the world we're living in now, defense planners have to compete for resources in ways that they haven't for the last 10 years, as the war has driven defense budgets north around the world. So for the next 10 years, we think that defense planners will be trying to work this problem of balancing security and other economic issues, and we wanted to bring a new perspective to that problem. That's why we wrote the report.
Right, and you can see it, like, you know, today, right now, what we're going through in terms of the budget and shutdown and trying to end sequestration and people having to make strategic choices about investments in defense versus, guns and butter. It's the old story, right?
Well, there's nothing really new under the sun, but you're right to say the guns and butter question is back with a vengeance. Since 9/11, it's true not just in the United States but around the world, defense strategy has largely driven budgets. But now, as we see in the U.S. policy debates, but also as we're seeing in Europe, even the Chinese, who we don't think of as terribly constrained in this way, are addressing, many for the first time, these big trade-offs between spending on defense versus spending on other government priorities versus making government smaller. Everyone is working this problem, and our defense planners are struggling because the tools that we used to use to work those problems have gotten a little rusty over the last 10 years. And we think that knocking the rust off those tools and becoming adept again at making these gun-butter trade-offs will be an important priority in the next several years.
All right. So, and that's a good way to get into the overview of the top 50 spenders. And as I understand it, those top 50 spenders on defense, the countries around the world, account for about 97% of the spend. Is that right?
Well, that's right. If you think about what the world as a whole spends on defense, it's a little less than $2 trillion a year. Now, $2 trillion, that's a lot of money even in Washington, D.C. But to put that into some context, the total product of the U.S. economy is about $15 trillion a year. A $2 trillion number is about what the economies of India or Russia produce in a year. And that number, the exact number is $1.7 trillion, is what the countries of the world spend on defense in 1 year. It's a staggering amount of money.
It sure is. So what percentage does the U.S. represent of that?
Well, the U.S. by itself represents 41% of the total global spending on defense. Now, that's twice our share in terms of gross domestic product. That is to say, the United States produces about 20% of the world's total economic output, but we spend about 40% of what the world spends on defense. It's 10 times our share of the population. So the United States is about 4 or 5% of the world's population, but we spend 40% of what the world spends on defense. By any measure, it is a staggering amount of resources. And that reflects a choice in the United States that we are going to invest very heavily in security. That's where we are today. So of the 193 countries that make up the United Nations General Assembly, the 193 members, 50 of those countries spend 97% of what the world spends on defense. One country, the United States, spends 41% of the global total. So we're a huge force. We are literally the 800-pound gorilla,
right,
of global defense.
And how's that relative to the other countries in terms of like the next 5 or 10, mm-hmm, or everybody thinks of China spending more and more on defense. But it's still a long way to go, right?
Well, the Chinese do spend a lot on defense, but if you take China, France, Japan, Russia, and Britain, the next 5 countries, group them all together, add up what they spend, that number is about half of what the U.S. spends in a year on defense. So we spend 41% of the global total. The next 5 that I just named add another 23%. So the top 6 spend about 2/3 of what the world spends on defense.
Wow. But there's also some interesting dynamics that you identify in the report in terms of the rate of growth of spending and what it means and who's making the investments, who versus who's cutting back. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, we thought that this was a very important finding as we looked at the public numbers on defense. Since 9/11, everybody grew defense budgets. I mean, there really is a pre-9/11 reality and a post-9/11 reality.
Right, and part of that's a post-Cold War world reality, right?
Yes, indeed.
In 91 or whatever when that...
91 was the previous kind of mark in the ground. But between 9/11 and about a year ago, all of the top 50 were increasing. Since 2006, 40 of the top 50 moved their budgets north, and only about 10 actually cut their budgets. And the ones that reduced their budgets were the countries where we saw economic crisis: Italy, Spain, Greece, Iran as the sanctions bit down, and Oman. Those are some of the countries that cut spending. But between 2006 and today, the top 50 increased their spending in total by about 22%. And most of that came from the United States.
Right. And Jack, right now we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Midgley. Jack is a director in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice. And we'll continue our discussion of, you know, where defense spending has been and where it's going. And you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Battlegrounds change, front lines evolve, but defense does not stop. How will you face down new threats with fewer dollars? Turn to Deloitte. We help leaders from CEOs to four-star generals deliver innovative, efficient solutions. With our private sector insight and public sector experience in technology, supply chain, analytics, and more, we'll help you shape the future of the DoD. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Fred News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice, and we are talking about the Global Defense Outlook 2013, Balancing Security and Prosperity, a study Deloitte issued this year looking at the top 50 defense spenders that account for 97% of global defense spending. And Jack, when we took the break, you had just indicated that from 2006 or so, that the growth in defense spending was about 22% amongst the top 50. And as we discussed during the break, is that, you know, that profile is changing rapidly. And in the case of the United States, I wanted to ask you about, you know, with the drawdown of Afghanistan and Iraq, and just the fiscal pressures on the United States, you know, what are the implications of that? Where is the United States going to be making investments, and what is our defense profile in terms of, I think, maintenance and repair kind of things, bringing stuff home? I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, the U.S. has drawn down defense spending at the end of every war, and this one will be no exception. So as the drawdown in Afghanistan is completed next year, the level of forces deployed overseas goes down, and the requirement to do combat operations, which currently get folded into the overseas contingency operations budget, will decline. But, you know, since calendar 2012, when the Iraq drawdown hit and the Afghanistan drawdown began, defense spending has gone down already from, in the calendar year 2012, $711 billion to $668 billion in the current fiscal year. That's a drop of $43 billion. It's the biggest year-over-year decline since 1991 and the end of the Cold War. Now, we think that's likely to continue to move down, but mainly because of just political pressure at the top line. So if you look back at the July House bill, for example, the July House bill proposed $600 billion in total defense outlays for fiscal 14, of which $512 billion was base budget and $82 billion for overseas contingency operations. So those numbers are going down. Part of the dialogue that we're seeing is the possibility of moving some of that OCO money that had been earmarked for overseas operations into the base budget to reflect the higher level of maintenance and recapitalization that'll be required at the end of the war. New equipment to replace equipment that's been worn out or unserviceable. There's, I think, some really interesting open questions about how much equipment is going to be moved back from the theater, or whether it just makes sense to leave it there or transfer it to the Afghans. So there's some interesting questions there. But the big story is that defense top line is likely to continue to move down in the direction of more historical.
Right. And sort of reflecting that over time is, you know, one of the things that the study was, I found really interesting is that, you know, that even though defense spending overall has been increasing, right, generally speaking, and now it's starting to be cut, but the conventional forces like numbers of tanks, active soldiers, surface ships and aircraft, they have declined over time. Can you talk a little bit about that? It's kind of although spending has either stayed relatively the same or and is now decreasing. But, you know, as you mentioned, that 22% increase from 2006 to 2011 or so, how does it happen that it's decreased, that it's increasing, but the numbers are decreasing?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people think about defense spending like a fire hose. You know, you kind of turn it on, you turn it off. But in fact, it's useful to think about it as many streams, individual streams. So across the whole top 50, defense spending went up 22% between 2006 and 2011. So we spent more in total. But the surprising fact is that if you look at what we actually, what those top 50 countries actually have in terms of defense assets, spending on general purpose forces and inventories of general purpose forces went down sharply. So in the same period when spending went up 22%, global inventories of tanks went down by 40%. The number of active soldiers went down by 11%. The number of principal surface combatants, those are Navy ships, destroyers, the capital ships of the Navy, dropped by 24%. And inventories of combat aircraft dropped by 14%. So we spent a lot more. I mean the whole top 50, spent a lot more. But what we have is actually a smaller total force than we had in 2006.
So what are we spent? What are the top 50 spending on then?
Well, the top 50 are recapitalizing. They're drawing down, and they're spending a lot more on soldier and retiree compensation. You know, I think it's pretty well known that the U.S. spends a lot on pay and benefits. But while we did the study, we even heard our colleagues in China talking about how they have to put incentives in place to keep soldiers in the military because the Chinese military is competing now with Chinese corporations, state-owned admittedly, but still corporations that can pay more. So everyone is dealing with a lot of complexity and cost drivers around keeping soldiers and taking care of families and taking care of retirees. That comes across when you look at how much the U.S. and other countries are now paying in terms of total cost for individual active soldiers.
Right. And so what is the U.S. number and how does it relate to some of the other countries?
Okay. Well, to get a sense for that, what we did was take the total spend that a country commits to in a year. We took a look at the total number of active forces. So we asked the question, what is the total cost spread across all the active soldiers? It's just simple division. So when you do that, what you find is that the U.S. spends about $400,000 a year per active soldier. Now, you can compare that to what countries in the Eurozone spend. That's about $240,000, much less. And what countries like Brazil, China, and India spend, which is about $45,000 on average, or almost one-tenth of what the U.S. spends. Now, that's not, as any active soldier will tell you, that's not because we pay our Army a lot of money.
Right, right.
It's because the United States operates a very capital-intensive force. So we spend a lot on technology. We spend a lot on procurement. We spend a lot on research and development. Other countries don't have aircraft carriers. Other countries don't have unmanned aerial vehicles. They don't invest in F-35 programs. We do. And that capital-intensive quality of our force drives the cost per soldier way up. But there are also other factors that are keeping the personnel costs very high. And if you like, we can talk about some of that.
Hey, go right ahead. Talk about them. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I think everyone wants the best for our soldiers. No one would ever argue that we shouldn't have the very best for our soldiers. But when you look at the numbers, what we found was that since fiscal year 2001, the beginning of the sort of post 9/11 era, pay and allowances and health care costs just in the United States have increased by 90%.
Wow.
Since 9/11. But our active end strength has only increased by 3%. We spend 90% more for a force that is only 3% larger than we had pre-9/11. And that staggering number does not include the expenses that we incur on behalf of our veterans. The Veterans Administration budget for the current year is $148 billion. That's not reflected in our defense
spending. That 90%.
That's not in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that VA number has increased by $100 billion a year since 2001. That is, in 2001,
right,
the VA budget was about $48 billion. Now it's $148 billion. So we have a magnificent professional force, widely understood to be the best active force that maybe the earth has ever seen. But we're paying for it.
Right.
And those costs are really hard to change. And that's one of the policy challenges that we're wrestling with in the United States, the Germans are wrestling with, and now even the Chinese, as I said, are beginning to wrestle with this high cost of personnel.
Right. Jack, we do right now. We have to take our next break, but when you come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Midgley. Jack is a director in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice, and we'll pick up on that question of personnel cost and what does it mean for the U.S. procurement budget moving forward. It's a question of size and quality versus costs. It goes back to the theme of the Global Defense Outlook 2013, Balancing Security and Prosperity, which is Deloitte's overview of where we are right now with regard to global defense spending. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
CACI delivers innovative information solutions and services to serve America's highest priorities, advancing efficiency and performance with business systems, countering the effects of complex threats with integrated security solutions, providing healthcare solutions for better, more affordable care, defending the nation against cyber threats, and helping veterans with its award-winning career-building program. CACI. Information deployed, solutions advanced, missions accomplished. CACI, ever vigilant.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice, and we are talking about Deloitte's report this year, Global Defense Outlook 2013, Balancing Security and Prosperity. And Jack, when we had to take that break, you were talking about the personnel costs and the increase that the United States has seen. And I guess, you know, my reaction when you say it's 3% increase in the number of, I guess, troops versus a 90% growth in the cost, that's not sustainable, is it?
No, no one thinks that's sustainable. And I mean, if you try to run that curve forward, it's
a cliff, right?
It's a total cliff. And we're going to have to address it with some structural measures. The trouble is that it's very hard politically or economically to talk about changes in the compensation structure or retirement benefits for people who are currently on active duty. It's just a really tough conversation. Another way to come at this, which is even less tractable, is to try to do it through rebalancing active and reserve forces, keeping less of the force in Title 10, very expensive federal benefit status, and moving more of the force structure into the reserves. That might look like an easy and obvious answer, but military leadership will often respond to that by saying it raises the level of risk and reduces the level of responsiveness of the force. So, as you know, as we've been saying from the beginning, this is about getting the proportions right. You know, it's about really thinking clearly about where you can control cost and what trade-offs you're prepared to accept. There's nothing free. If we try to change force structure to reduce cost, one can make the argument that we add risk and reduce readiness. If you try to reduce cost by cutting soldier pay and benefits, people will argue, I think legitimately, that you can have an effect on recruiting and retention. Nothing's free. But no one believes that we can keep growing costs 90% every decade and not grow the force. It doesn't make economic sense or military sense.
Right. That's the issue, size and quality versus cost, right?
Yes,
and
that's
trying
right.
to get that equation correct for, you know, to be able to respond to future risk. So, you know, that issue has to be addressed. But and what is the corresponding impact on the defense procurement budget when you think about that increased defense spending? That goes to the quality of the overall force as well, right? The investments in equipment, capitalization, those things you talked about.
Well, a dollar that we spend on soldier pay and benefits is a dollar that's not available to spend on better equipment, better weapons, and so forth. So that's another reason why that has to be addressed. But military pay, it's important, particularly active component soldier pay, is less than half of what DOD spends on overall compensation. So there's a lot of civilian compensation. There's civilian benefits. It's a complex, a nuanced problem, and it's going to have to be addressed systematically and with facts.
Right. It's almost like that fire hose analogy you used earlier, right? It's not one stream. There's many different streams and pieces of the puzzle that you have to figure out, right?
That's right.
And put it together so it works for all of us. So I'd like to get your thoughts. So what will the defense procurement budget be focusing on moving forward? We hear a lot about special forces, drones, cybersecurity. Those seems to be the flavors of the day right now.
Well, as we looked across the 50, it became very clear that all of the top 50 are emphasizing growing special operations capabilities. All of them, are exploring, and some very actively exploring, the use of unmanned aerial vehicles. And all of the top 50 now have some level of military cyber capability. None of that would have been true pre-9/11. So in that respect, the growth areas seem pretty clear to us. And those are certainly three key growth areas.
So in terms of, let's just talk about special operations forces, and what does it mean in the United States that we will, like the rest of the top 50, invest more in special operations forces? What does it mean for the defense industrial base? Where are we going with that?
Well, a couple of things. SOF is hard to deal with public data. Countries don't.
So we don't know where we're going with it, right?
We do.
Right.
Countries don't publish numbers about what they spend on special operations forces. But they do talk about what capabilities they're building. And a couple of the conversations are particularly interesting to us. One is the current effort that the U.S. Special Operations Command has talked about publicly about promoting regional coordination centers. So there are a lot of efforts underway now to link U.S. special operations capabilities with regional capabilities in all parts of the world. And on its face, that seems to make very solid operational sense. And that's why people are doing it. But investing in the kinds of command and control technologies that are required to accomplish that level of coordination, support for training, support for mobility, communication systems, and so forth, all seem to be areas where there is intense interest, not just in the United States, but across all of the top 50. By contrast, if you're in the tank business is not so good. Tank inventories have dropped. That decline is particularly marked in the developing world. If you look, if you look at Russia and China, tank inventories have dropped sharply. So U.S. orders for tanks have basically disappeared, and now most tank orders are coming from emerging economies. Countries like Bangladesh are buying tanks, but they're not buying them from the United States.
Yeah, I'm sure they
buy them. Yeah. They buy them from India. They buy them from elsewhere. But in the SOF arena, there is clearly a lot of emphasis on increased regional coordination, on partnership, and on advanced transportation, command and control, those kinds of technologies.
And it seems to me, I guess, and you can validate this or not, the lack of investment or the reductions in, tanks versus the growth of special operations forces reflects where people think, warfare is going in the future. And I was just thinking about while you were talking, the example this past weekend where, you know, they picked up the Al Qaeda guy in Libya, right? And then they did the raid in Somalia. Is that, that's sort of, it seems to me, representative of what we anticipate. You never know, but what we anticipate, you know, the way conflict is going.
Well, you know, it raises a really interesting question that I think was part of our challenge as we tried to think about what soft looks like worldwide. And that is the blurring line between military operations and police operations. So a lot of the growth that we're seeing in special operations capabilities doesn't show up in defense budgets. It's reflected in interior ministry and national police capabilities, which we used to think about as law enforcement functions. So, you know, the blurring line between what's a military operation and what is a police action indicates that, you know, the possibility for growth in special operations capabilities for sure. But it raises some really hard public policy questions about, you know, what can the military do? What's the edge between police and military? And that's one of the reasons that soft capability is hard to describe or hard to define in a global way.
Right. And, you know, it seems to me, I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking about the FBI going to Kenya to help in that investigation, right, of, you know, the mall attack. And it turns around and they, you know, there's a raid in Somalia trying to get the guys who masterminded that. To me, that sort of reflects what you're talking about, that where the line is.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, if you think about what, for example, what General McChrystal did with special operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of his theory of how that was supposed to work dealt with integrating the intelligence collection and operating capabilities across a whole interagency spectrum. That's really hard to do. Since 9/11, we've learned how to do that. Countries around the world have learned how to do that in a military operational way. What we'll be dealing with over the next years is how do you start to do that when unmanned aerial vehicles are available to both military and police organizations, or when cyber capabilities are available to law enforcement and to military. Those same kinds of levels of integration are going to be part of the public policy challenge in these next 10 years or so.
Right. Jack, we do have to take our last break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Midgley. Jack is a director in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice. And when we come back, we'll talk about a little bit more about drones, and we'll talk cybersecurity. And you teed it up. We can talk about that, you know, that division between law enforcement versus, you know, armed conflict, I guess, and where you draw that line and what this all also means for civil liberties versus security. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a principal in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice, and we are talking about Deloitte's 2013 report, Global Defense Outlook 2013, Balancing Security and Prosperity. And Jack, I wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, in this last segment, drones and cybersecurity, two things that get a lot of headlines these days. And, you know, particularly drones appear to be pretty darn effective. Can you talk about, I guess, you know, where the United States is with drones? And I know, and from looking at the report and talking to you, I understand that there's all kinds of different size drones. You know, different capabilities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The old idea of a drone that kind of sticks in the public mind is what our military friends like to describe as you know, warheads on foreheads, the lethal drone operations that all of us have seen on television. But the world of unmanned aerial vehicles, the more technical description of a drone, is really very broad. We like to think of a spectrum. You know, at one end are little handheld vehicles like the Black Hornet, which is a palm-sized drone that the British forces use in Afghanistan. It's made by a company in Norway called Prox Dynamics, and a soldier literally throws this thing, and it flies to a point on the ground and turns on a camera. So it's great for seeing around corners, but it's very small, costs a couple hundred dollars. At the other end of the spectrum are systems like the new Northrop Grumman, the XB-47, that sailors call the Salty Dog drone. You might remember in July, there were some great pictures of that drone landing on the George Bush aircraft carrier by itself.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
Well, that system, that is definitely not thrown from your hand. That thing weighs a couple of tons. It carries 4,500 pounds worth of weapons. It can fly 2,000 miles. It can be refueled in midair. It flies at 40,000 feet. It has stealth capability. It's an enormously capable airplane. So now when we're talking about drones or unmanned aerial vehicles, it's important to remember that there's a very broad spectrum. The published data tell us that governments are spending about $5 billion a year worldwide on unmanned aerial vehicles. And most people tell us that that number is going to double over the next 10 years. There are 40 companies that make drones. Some of them are in the United States. Some of them are in Europe. A few are in South Africa. And some of the best are in Israel. The U.S. is going to spend over the next 10 years about two-thirds of the total global R&D on drones and about half the procurement dollars. So we'll still be the largest market. People are surprised, though, to find that most of the growth isn't around the lethal systems. Rather, it's around the sensor payloads, the eyes and the sensing equipment that go on to unmanned aircraft. And there's a whole range of them. There are electro-optical and infrared systems. There's signals intelligence systems, command and control systems. That's what people are really investing in, is getting this technology mounted onto an unmanned vehicle. So there's also a lot of growth in that small end of the market, the handheld, because sure. law enforcement can use those. So there's a lot there going on. Most of the exports of drones, though, and this is a big challenge for the U.S., the biggest exporters of drones are all in Israel. So the Israelis don't have the same import-export restrictions that U.S. companies face. So Elbit and Israel Aerospace are among the largest exporters of drone technology in the world.
Wow. And with the idea of law enforcement using drones, mm-hmm. that also, I guess that raises some folks' concerns about, you know, civil liberties or even people being able to, your neighbor, you could have a drone and look at what your neighbor's up to. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Well, of course it makes sense. I mean, people have been flying little hobby rockets and hobby airplanes with cameras on them for decades. We're, I think, going to see a rise in the intelligence of those systems, the capabilities of those systems. And if you think about this from a public policy perspective, it's going to raise some really interesting edge questions. Where does the law enforcement role end? Where does the military role begin? What constitutes an inappropriate infringement on civil liberty, and what's an acceptable level of surveillance? Those are really tough political questions that we're going to have to wrestle with because this new technology has become so incredibly capable.
Right. Okay, so let's turn to – and I have to tell you, when you're saying that, I was at a football game this weekend, and over on that adjacent field, somebody was flying their plane, right, with the handheld control. Yeah. It was pretty amazing to watch what he could get that plane to do. So cybersecurity, you know, that is also – you know, something that we hear about all the time, government websites getting hacked, cyber spying, you know, business to business, you know, spying, that sort of thing. Where are we going in cybersecurity?
It's a big question. 10 years ago.
I try to ask big questions on this show.
Well, you succeeded on that one. 10 years ago, cyber really meant technical network security. It was about keeping people away from systems with passwords and other security measures. Now, as we looked across the top 50, what we see is cyber emerging as a military operational domain. in the same way that land, air, space, sea are operational domains. Now cyberspace has become a place where commanders and staffs think about targets, they think about countermeasures, they think about defensive actions. And now, unlike 10 years ago, I think the really interesting problems around cyber are not technical. They are policy problems. They're legal problems. They go to, for example, as we were saying with drones, edges and roles. You know, where can military cyber operations take place? For example, if an attack is mounted inside the United States by a third country national against a government system, whose responsibility is it to defend against that, to detect it, to respond to it? Those questions aren't obvious. They don't have easy answers. If you cede all that authority to the military, many people become uncomfortable with what feels like an intrusion into the domestic life of the nation. If you rely on law enforcement or private entities to do it, then maybe we have an unacceptable level of risk. So as the domain matures and as people think more about the vast technical capability, both to attack and to defend in cyberspace, these edge questions, the policy questions, are going to be debated very actively in the next 10 years. They're not easy. There aren't right and wrong answers. It's about trade-offs and proportions.
Right. And it sounds to me, too, it's about organization. How is the government going to
very
be
much so.
How is the government going to be organized to defend against, you know, cyber attacks and also potentially carry them out at some point as needed, right?
It's the area of warfare that is the most joint. That is, it runs across services.
Sure.
It's the most combined. It doesn't pay much attention to national borders. And it's the most inherently interagency domain. FBI, CIA, military all have resources that have to be brought to bear. And our current structures for security are based on an old world where geography still mattered.
Right.
And in cyberspace, the geography is very different. So we're going to have to wrestle with those, as you call them, structural questions and get the policy right so that we don't wind up trying to figure this out after a major attack.
Right. So, and does it, you know, I think about cyber, I think about it becoming the new, you know, sort of mutual assured destruction, you know, the idea of nukes, in the sense that, you know, a cyber attack could shut everything down theoretically, right? I mean, there's computer chips everywhere, right? You know, utilities, you know, the banking system, all that sort of thing. Like, you could literally shut down a country, couldn't you?
Well, I don't know about shutting down a whole country. I think in one respect, it's not so much the next kind of mutual assured destruction as it is the next phase or domain for global terrorists who are able to operate.
Okay, that's a good point.
At a very low level of cost, a relatively low level of violence, but disproportionate effects. And in that respect, the issue is less these massive country-closing attacks
sure.
than it is, you know, point targets against right. An individual business or an individual agency.
Yeah, I find myself thinking in the old
yeah.
sort of convention of country versus country when it really is a new dynamic, right?
Yeah.
Right. Jack, unfortunately, and I say that I really mean unfortunately, we've run out of time. I'm going to have you come back and we can continue the conversation. But I want to thank my guest, Jack Midgley. Jack is a director in Deloitte's Global Defense Consulting Practice. And you have been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.